Let's begin with prayer.
Gracious God,
teach us to be a partying people, as you are our partying God, whom we know in Jesus the Christ. Amen. Only two more times to ring the bell at the end of my fun here at home. I rarely figure out how I'm going to begin the class, but my wife helped me this morning by telling me that she woke up dreaming about building a house. And if nothing else, we'll put the fear of God in you, you know. Now, she has good and deep understanding of what dreams mean. Of course, all I could see was her with an electric saw. And I'm glad she woke up, because I got out of bed quickly. But it reminded me of my favorite story. Oh, no, I shouldn't say mine. My kid's favorite story about me. It was when our youngest daughter finally left home and we had an extra room. We raised five children in three bedrooms. And so when she left and they were all gone, of course, we were going to redo that room. And eventually made it into, quote, our pillow room, which was delightful. Part of it we put carpeting in. And, of course, then the door wouldn't close. So nobly, I took the door out to the garage and cut a piece off of it, brought it back in, and discovered I cut it off the top of the door. I think that house still has that door with that part glued back on. I don't know. But I can't understand why my kids always love to tell that story. But it probably is the reason why I'm here leading Bible study and not on operations here at Holden Village. We've been talking about meals and Eucharist. Going to continue to talk about it with a little different flip. I guess this is a self-revelation. This whole thing should have taken care of all week, but I didn't want to get in a rut, so I'm not going to use this morning. I'm going off to another kind of a meal, and we'll be keeping some of this in, but we'll come back to this tomorrow when we talk about Zacchaeus and the meal he threw for Jesus. We're going to jump to a story about parties, which includes, of course, feasting and even a fatted calf in the story of what we call the prodigal son. Going to be using a lot of ideas from Robert Farrar Capon, who writes a lot of good, Episcopalian, who writes a lot of good stuff. Wait, what was his first one? Something about eating, wasn't it? Because he's, pardon?
Bed and board.
Well, bread and board, I guess.
Bed and board.
Bed and board, right, yeah. Way back. I don't know when he first doing all this. This is 1988. There's a more recent one that's called The Mystery of Christ and Why We Don't Get It. That is really a helpful book, too. I didn't check whether any of these are in the bookstore. If they are, I'm supposed to encourage you to buy them. I done my duty. What Capon does in this story of the prodigal son is tie partying to the death motif. So again, this sort of follows last night's discussion about, quote, right to die, unquote, because there's a lot of death involved in the story that we call the prodigal son. I'm saying it that way because one of the other persons calls it the reluctant brother, the story of the reluctant brother, and others people, of course, call it the story of the loving father. The uniqueness, I think, of Capon's effort here is to tie death into this and maybe hint at one of the reasons we don't do much real partying, or that a lot of our partying is fake, is that we still haven't dealt with the death motif in not only our physical life, but in our spiritual journey as well. So we'll bounce around on that. But let's get the story in front of us once again. So I'll ask if two people will be willing to read, one from 11 to 24 and the other from 25 to 32. Familiar story, but it's good to hear again. Someone start off?
I will.
Okay.
And he said, there was a man who had two sons. And the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of property that falls to me. And he divided his living between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took his journey to a far country. And there he squandered his property in loose living. And when he had spent everything, a great famine arose in that country, and he began to be in want. So he went and joined himself to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed swine. And he would gladly have fed on the pods that the swine ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have bread enough and to spare? But I perish here with hunger. I will rise and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. And he arose and came to his father. But while he was yet at a distance, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, bring quickly the best robe and put it on, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring the fatted calf and kill it. And let us eat and make merry. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to make merry.
Please, someone else.
Now his elder son was in the field. And as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what this meant. And he said to him, your brother has come, and your father has killed the fatted calf, because he has received him safe and sound. But he was angry and refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him, but he answered his father, lo, these many years I've served you, and I've never disobeyed your command, yet you never gave me a kid that I might make merry with my friends. But when this son of yours came and has devoured your living with harlots, you killed for him the fatted calf. And he said to him, son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to make merry and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found.
Thank you. I'll try to do some commentary on this and some of the things that I have thought of and that I've been stimulated to think about by a couple of books. I'm going to plug this book, too, if you want to have fun with Luke, Frederick W. Danker, who's 2 years ahead of me at seminary. We call him Fred the Red, a red-haired guy, who's a great student of Luke, and it's a great book about it, and fairly simple so that clergy can understand it, and also that laity will respect it. I think the neat thing about Fred is he hasn't gotten over yet having used to be in the Missouri Synod, and so every once in a while there's lines in there that are Donald Clausthain would recognize and I would do strictly. A slash at old Missouri, not said that way, but you know where Fred was coming from when he wrote this. And I chuckle when I read the book, too. It's a good one. The second edition of it, and he's the guy who did a Greek scholar, who the book on Greek dictionary is the Arndt Gingrich book, is his prof, Arndt, worked on it. And then he redid it, and worldwide use of that book, any English-speaking use of that book around the world. But anyway, back to Capon. It starts out at the beginning of the chapter, again, that the Pharisees are grumbling. Somebody told me about a very lovely sermon. I don't know where it took place, where the pastor was dealing with this particular text, and he had the people grumbling in the congregation. Not because they were good at it, he told them, but that grumbling might sound good in the sermon, so they'd grumble. And as usual, this has come up a number of times in our meal stories when Jesus goes associating with those wrong people again, grumble, grumble, grumble. And there's a way of looking at the three stories then that Jesus tells, the lost sheep, the lost coin, the lost son, that are seen as a gentle and winsome effort again to win the Pharisees over to Jesus' view of God. Now and so what this is about this morning is, again, to help us be won over, as I think we are almost constantly needed to do, to be won over to Jesus' view of God. Don't forget, although we do a lot of talking about Jesus, they're going to celebrate, they're going to have a party.
It's just the junior minors.
All right. Maybe what we ought to do is just go and watch the party. Yeah. That although we do a lot of talking about Jesus, Jesus did a lot of talking about God. Probably most of the Gospels are about the Father. And we're so interested in getting that in between, which is good. But if we're listening well to Jesus, we're listening about the Father and getting a right, a better idea about God. And the way Capon goes at this particular section, he talks about it in terms of the death motif. And he says there's plenty of death in the story if you look close enough. Right off the bat, the father dies. The son says, let's put your will into effect. You're dead. Bye-bye. Fade away. No more father. I don't know how you picture the father. Again, the usual thing is pretty old now and all that stuff. If they didn't, the age range isn't that long. It could have been sparkling 40, and energetic, dashes down the road after a while. He probably had Nikes or something like that and got out there fast. Energetic, the energeticness of the father. I mean, he ducks out here, he goes out there. He isn't sitting around, he isn't doddering. So there's an energetic father, but he dies in the first two verses, according to Capon's view of this story. So they split up, and it wouldn't be equal. The first son, the oldest, gets more, twice what the others. And so 2/3 to the reluctant brother, and 1/3 to the son. By the way, the Greek word that's used when he splits in our text, it says, so he divided his property between him. The Greek word said is probably closer to his living. And so if he gave away his living, there's a hint at another death right here too. The living was given away, the zoe kind of thing in the Greek language. And then the second death is the son, after he shoots the wad in riotous living or whatever else it was. His reluctant brother, of course, saw it with harlotry, because again, men tend to think that's the only thing that men will do, and certainly that women are willing to cooperate in and all that kind of business. But anyway, whatever did, he shoots the whole thing, comes to his senses, and almost recognizes, Capon is very sort of fussy about this here, that he is dead. That he's dead. He said, really? And then he confesses, he writes the confession, he rehearses it. I'll go home to my father and I'll say, I am not worthy to call you, and all this. But Capon says he probably wasn't really dead until he experienced forgiveness. Let me read that section to you. Where is it? 139. Or thereabout. Oh, yeah. All real confession is subsequent to forgiveness, he says. Every confession a Christian makes bears witness to this, because every confession, public or private, and every absolution, specific or general, is made and given subsequent to the one baptism we receive for the forgiveness of sins. How's this connecting with Erlander? We are forgiven in baptism not only for the sins committed before baptism, but for a whole lifetime of sins yet to come. Many of us Lutherans don't like that kind of talk. Sounds too free and easy. We're accused, as Lutherans specifically, of being cheap with grace. We are forgiven before, during, and after our sins. And we are forgiven for one reason only, because Jesus died for our sins and rose for our justification. So he's portraying the second death as really being complete when the confession becomes real to the Son, when his dad grabs him before he can even spit the words out of confession. That kind of partying father. Capon reminds us that Luke portrays a God who in human terms would be a maniac. Remember the story of the people invited to the thing, they don't come? And he goes out and looks and searches and screams and finds and pulls and everything else. Still not enough. Got them filled up. Go out again. You know, a maniac. For crying out loud, have the party, forget. No way. The same here. The Father really, really, really grabs. And the third death for Capon is the fatted calf. He sees the fatted calf as the Christ figure in the story, sitting around waiting for what he was to be used for, and then gives up the life. The father comes back to life. The prodigal comes back to life. Fatted calf doesn't make it, but you know, you can't make everything, as Capon says, you can't make everything work. So, but that's his story, and he focuses on the fatted calf as that symbol for celebration right off the bat. He portrays that what takes place between us and God is one life for another. We're always busy trying to earn our ways, work it out, negotiate, whatever it may be. And we find out that after we've done everything, there's nothing, and all God expects is our life. And then when we give our life, or when our life is given to God, then God says, yep, that's the cost. It's one life for another life. And then after this acceptance of forgiveness, the Son starts to see life again, because it is necessary for us to make merry, because my Son was lost and is found. My Son was dead and is alive again. When we are tempted, or without thinking, you know, try to make grace cheap, or on the other hand, end up still bouncing away at guilt. Steve's matins this morning gave us a lot to do, a lot to do, a lot to do. And that's right. One of the reasons Holden's here is to push us to a lot to do. But it's after our life has been taken, exchanged with Jesus Christ, that we're able to do that. And that's where we get the power to do all the lot to do. So on both sides, whether we make it too easy or too hard and end up with guilt, what the focus of this story is that one life has been given already for us, and that we are now, it is necessary to make merry. That the Greek word says that it is required to make merry. That's not negotiable. Because of that exchange, what we are about is partying. what God is about, is partying, to celebrate what has been done. When I read in here that, you know, the trumpets blast and the drums go, it reminded me, you know, when I grew up, organs were the thing, you know, in church music. And I was blessed with some marvelous organists. I think I still am proud of the fact that I turned pages for Paul Bunyas up in Wisconsin, a great organist. And Hugo Gehrke, Jerry Schroth, and good grief, Paul Bowman, who else that I bounced off of in listening to their music, and I agreed. But now there's other stuff, you know, and Michael, whose last name I can't remember, at First Lutheran, great organist, member of the Organist Guild and all that stuff. But he spends a lot of time playing piano, spends a lot of time beating drums and other stuff. And I decided that I want to listen for the party in the drum beats and in the trumpets. Because in our society, that's a signal of that. It isn't offensive, it isn't out of place, and it doesn't have to be, but it can be a doggone good single. It's the signal of partying. And even my son's Yamaha might fit into that.
Pretty good job.
Right. I'm going to do something. I'm going to apply some of this to Holden, but let me do some other stuff first. Danker points out the great energy that God puts into this partying and seeking the lost, and especially the gaiety of the Father. He learned enough not to say gay. He did say gaiety. I was going to read this too. He's quoting a story in the Christian Century. The writer requested help from a pastor and his congregation for the rehabilitation of a parolee. After a series of disappointing attempts to interest Christians, he told a story to a friend who dealt professionally with troubled people. His friend reminded him that the church is not for sinners. It has become the place where people can come together once a week to reaffirm a sense of well-being and acceptance in society. They come not out of a sense of guilt or sinfulness, but to make overt manifestation of their righteousness and goodness. Most churchgoers, he said, look on the fallen with scorn and distrust. They would find it practically impossible to speak to the needs of a recognized sinner. Well, we're all sinners, but we're all closet sinners, right? And I'm not for spreading it all out. You've got to do a spiritual striptease every time you get in some kind of a setting like that. But to recognize our oneness with sinners, and so we, you know, go around calling people rabble and riffraff and niggers and wops and mother F and parolees and child molesters, and we use names like McVeigh and Simpson in derogatory ways, rather than recognizing who we are in the midst of it. So instead of in this human story that we have in front of us, if it being just a human story, it's a God story. And the human story is very real. And the God story is even more real. And we end up focused because we understand wasting our substance, but we don't understand partying for the right reason, I guess. And that leads me to say something about Holden. Not just now, but in the range of my experience here. We do a lot of talking at Holden about being advocates and getting out there and doing the job. And sometimes long-term staff see any of the rest of us who come here as sort of busybodies who sneak in for a while. Some staff do this. And sometimes staff see us as suburban people wanting to get a kick in the mountains. And anyway, it's pretty cheap. And we aren't really sincere about it all. That's tough. And I've got a lot of sympathy for long-term staff who live here and then all of a sudden have, as when we worked very hard not to use this language when I was here, this horde of invaders, which is called the summer program. And the place was started in the summer and didn't have any winter. And it was all about the summer, but you know, things get turned around. And then people who come here long-term discover that there's all kinds of sinners here too. And so long-term staff has a tough time with 3-week staff and 2-month staff. And then they find out that the singles in the community are annoyed by the ones who have never had children, but annoyed by the families that come here with their children. And as most singles believe, you know, parents are the worst parents they ever seen everywhere. Until they get to be parents, of course. So, you know, there's all kinds of difficulties that surround a place like this. And so when somebody asks you to pray for Holden, don't only pray for the fund drive that's coming up, which I think is terribly important, but also for the community here, which struggles a lot. The real world isn't only out there. Of course it is, but it's here too. And there's struggles. There's people here who work 12 hours a day and others who work a neat little 7.5. And when you see your neighbor sitting quaffing a beer on the front porch swing as you're wrapping up 11.5 hours or something, well, there are a lot of humans here too. So that's another part of it, how to keep the partying spirit here in the most honest way possible for the people who are here. And therefore, to try and have the folks that are here as much part of our programming, because their insights about this text and other stuff here, I think, are most important, too. We don't have the only view of it. And so we still can end up visiting Holden and go away with a lot of guilt and a lot of fear of death because our God is too small. I think I said this earlier in the week of dear Joe Sittler reminding us 40-some years ago that the whole idea of redemption always swings within the orbit of creation. And that, therefore, the view of God as creator and supporter of everything going on is very important for us to have if we're going to understand what redemption is all about. And that we have a large enough understanding of a God who is redeeming all the things in all of the world, and not only the church or not only individuals, but indeed systems that are surrounding us too, not just us. I don't know how Dan says it, but I know he says it in some way. Otherwise, what's the meaning of the life? Because surely, when we're baptized, God could have flipped us into heaven. You know, baptism, or fine, it's over. No way, here. We're baptized for here. For the life to be lived here. The life to be partied here. As I think Luke reminds us here. And maybe that's one of our problems with the quote, the right to die thing last night. That we don't believe the party. That if we had a partying God somehow, and I don't stay in it all the time, I'm implying that I do, but if we have a partying God, then we're going to go to the party, you know? I wrote something when a dear friend of mine died a long time ago. Dear friend, Louis Marty. Never been in the hospital in his life till the night in a camp out near Lake Tahoe. The old heart gave away. And I viewed God saying to Louis when he read, that first thing Lou heard was a little chuckle. And God said, well, it wasn't so tough, was it, Lou? And I think so. Well, what you might also hear is some drums beaten, some trumpets blowing, and a whole big fat party going on. And you're going to run like mad to try to catch up with the party. I don't know how I got that way. Somebody in the first session asked about how you get this way, and I don't know how I got that way, but all of a sudden it dawned on me, maybe for my mom, who my dad was the more serious of us. He's the one who read the prayer book every night. Every night, no matter what time he came in. Stark's prayer book. I remember him sitting there. But my mom was the party goer. Much rather go downtown Chicago and see a movie at the Chicago Theater than take care of her kids. Fortunately, she had an aunt who became the one who spoiled me real well, and my three brothers. And eighth grade education, my mom. And maybe I learned a little bit about partying from her, and without knowing it, without maybe her knowing it too. God gave me a marvelous close with her. Maybe I should have shared this last night, I don't know. That she was sick for only a month. On December 24th, she collapsed in the nursing home, or the retirement place she was. And it was cancer of the liver, and she was only sick for a month. To my knowledge, never complained during that month. Once she said to me, Helmer, why can't they make me well? That's all. And then I had a farewell. She was up near O'Hare when I lived way south, and two or three times a week I drove up there, 60 miles I guess it was one way. And during her days of being well, the visits in the car going back and forth there turned out to be just great stuff. Talked about all kinds of things. But that night, Wednesday night of that week, I went to a snowstorm was starting, and I went to the nursing home up near Gulf Mill, if anybody knows the Chicago area. And I got there, they were changing her bed. And she had pretty well wasted away. And you know, me, I don't know, stand there, no way. Am I in the way or what? And I said, you know, can I do anything? And then the nurse said, yeah, pick her up. She had no clothes on. And I held her in my arms the way she held me, with no clothes on. And I talked to her some more when she was back in bed, and I knew it was the last time. She was in a coma, I suppose. I just assumed she could hear me. And by the time I got outside, it was a real wing-dinger of a Chicago snowstorm going. And I have no idea how I got home, because I cried the whole way home. Tears just pouring down, and the windshield wipers going back and forth, and heavy, wet Chicago snow coming down to get home. When I got home, I had no idea how I got there. Suddenly discovered I was home. It was Wednesday, and Friday morning, they called and said, your mom died. I'm really, really, really grateful for that woman. And by the way, I discovered she was a bother. I had to personally take away her credit cards. She had no money, but she used her credit cards. Well-trained American. And she would call, and she'd do all kinds of crazy things, and tried to be a daughter to my first wife, and Ginny was trying to explain she had enough kids. But when she was gone, and I missed my dad. He died when I was 17. But boy, I didn't expect to miss her, but I did. Those doggone rides back and forth. I missed them like mad. And as I said, maybe my eighth grade mom taught me. Not knowing it, and me not knowing it, a lot about partying. And if so, I'm great. But isn't it like God to use crazy stuff like that to teach you when you don't know it? And an eighth grader to do it? See, to Ben and the minors out here teaching us. Another thing that happened in the first session, this is the advantage of the second session, is a fellow sitting over there says, I'm a seminary student. He says, good grief, this doesn't sound like any God I'm hearing about. He said, I don't want to pick on seminaries, but he says, I'm getting the Augsburg Confession shoved down my throat, and he said, I don't get a partying God. Well, that's sad, and that's probably a little bit of exaggeration. And I pointed out to him that professors at the seminary aren't all theologians. They're teachers, and many of them very good, of course. But one of my fun things being here at Holden through the years has been visiting with seminary presidents who come here, especially at the dinner table, and then to quietly and subtly ask, how many theologians you've got on your faculty? Oh, a dirty question. And I think the wise ones will say two or three. Meaning, someone who has put the whole thing together has a word, theology, theosology, word about God, really together. And those are the ones that we listen to. Richard R. Kemmerer, Sr., being one that did that for me at the seminary. Not many. But through all of life, if you get a couple of good teachers, my gosh, be satisfied. Mm-hmm. My kids had, each of them different, one good teacher in high school. Good teacher. That still are doing things to them. And the same would be about seminary. So we have to listen for people like that. And I'm struggling inside of myself, but I'll repeat what I said in the first session, in spite of people who are present. I think one of the theologians who comes to Holden Village is a guy named Dan Erlander, who has a word about God put together. And as I said last time, he'll be the first one to maybe deny it. So I say, listen to him. Please do. He's got a message for us, a partying message that accepts and acknowledges baptism as being not only forgiveness of sins past, but of future as well. And so we should be partying people. One person in the first session, now and then I'll stop, said also, but what if the story said the kid that went out and did that did this for the seventh time? Then what? And later on, then she said, I'm at the end of a rope, my rope, with my brother. And my answer is, same as Jesus said about 70 times 7. My gosh, that's the stuff. I don't do it well. Up and down with people that I'm struggling with, for sure. Sometimes I'm angry. Sometimes I ignore them. Sometimes I pout. Sometimes I cuss. Whatever it may be. And sometimes I reach out. And sometimes I hug. But my goal is still to see the party. And this person is part of the party. And hoping that the person will see the exchange of life for life, of death leading to party again. That's tough stuff, but it's where I think all of us probably are. Well, that's enough. Your reaction and comments and sharing. Yes?
I'd like to share my mother's story of partying, death and partying. My mother died 3 weeks before my daughter's wedding. And the reason I think about it, had she not died, she would never have been able to go to the wedding. She had been gradually, I'm assuming she had Alzheimer's for 5 years. And because she died, I think she purposely died because she wanted to be at the wedding. Mm-hmm. I feel she was at the wedding. Yeah. We were all at her funeral. We all celebrated then, her life. And 3 weeks later, we had this wonderful wedding party. Mm-hmm. And the reason I bring it up is it was maybe just a month or two later, I read in The Good Housekeeping, it's Emily Post or somebody, and somebody had written a question about whether it was proper because a wedding had been, they went to a wedding that somebody whose the mother had died mm-hmm. a few weeks before. I'm sure it wasn't anyone from yeah. my family that wrote it. But the response was that, well, they should have toned down the wedding. Oh, they should have not canceled it. They should have toned down. I was so offended by that because my mother would have been just, she would have died.
Oh, I love it.
Because she, as far as I'm concerned, she was at that wedding. The bride and groom on the way to the reception stopped and put the rose on her mm-hmm. gravesite that had been already purchased for her, you know, that had been planned. Mm-hmm. And because that's the kind of person she was. Like, she enjoyed having people around. She enjoyed that. And I just think that, you know, she was there, mm-hmm. and God was there. It was a beautiful wedding, a beautiful time.
Good. Thank you very much. Gloria, and then over here.
I, you know, of course, like all of us, I've heard this story many times, and I've heard it taught a fair number of times. And I remember one teacher asking us to identify with one of the people mm-hmm. in the story, you know, and I think I have often in the past identified with the older brother. I'm an older sister, and that's a responsible mm-hmm. position. But I guess what I'm old enough now to have a little different perspective, and what I realize now is that older brother should have partied along the way and taken time and had fun himself, mm-hmm. and then he wouldn't have resented this party. A lot of folks around who just work themselves and resented them sure. if anybody else is having fun.
Capon talks about him as a bookkeeper. I did this, I did do this, I did this. And then I told the story in the first session about some guy who goes around telling about pointless people who don't keep score. And he's a bookkeeper. Apparently Capon knows some very dour bookkeepers who are checking it all off. Yeah, that's good, thanks.
One comment on what you're saying. We went to a Catholic wedding where the couple did it in the Latin, Latino style. And one of the parts of the wedding, they all got together and they named the names of deceased people who they knew. And they said, presente.
Ah!
And they were all present then at that wedding. Mm-hmm. So it was a communion both with the families and friends who were there, plus those who had passed on before them, which was a beautiful, beautiful thing. The other comment I had too is, how many people have seen Kimura's picture of the laughing Jesus? That was brought into our church, a print of that, and it was amazing people's reaction to that, to see Jesus laughing. Some thought it was great, and some were offended by it. So we see Jesus probably as we see ourselves.
Right.
The preacher preached on this text this spring, I guess. I don't know, it's still fresh in my mind, but he preached for about 20 minutes, and he had all 300 people, you know, both services, repeat twice, lost, found, party. Everybody got the sermon.
Yeah, right. Good luck.
Loud and clear. Lost, found, party. Yeah.
Martin Marty says, Americans are capable of remembering three words. When I come to Holden, there's always a little sadness, and forgive me if this sounds, I don't know what it sounds like, but of people being here that didn't know Carol Henderly.
Yes.
Oh my, what a partier. Oh my gosh, he was, a crazy, crazy, crazy nut. And I've said this before in Bible sessions these last 2 weeks. Sure, he had, what is it you have up to your knees or up to your feet or neck or something? He had all kinds of defects, of course he did. But he was a partier. And his craziness for partying was what made this place what it is. By God's grace, no question about it. A nut from the first order, and you never knew what to expect. I always loved it. It was when you would arrive at noon on a day, and you would be welcomed at noon meal in the dining hall, and he would introduce my family, and he says, "Elmer's leading Vespers tonight." Which, of course, is the first I heard of it, you know. A crazy party giver, marvelous person, so when you pray for Holden, include a thanks for Carol and Mary, who made Carol work, of course, I mean, inside. And then for the community, which still has all the struggle. The real world is here as well as out there. And pray for that part of it. And pray for the fundraising, too, that's coming up. Getting in a plug. Anybody else?
Fundraising?
Yeah. Pardon?
Fundraising.
Yeah, I did it again.
With or without a D.
Without it, yeah. Add your own D's.
You know, yeah. I've been wondering if the older brother's attitude would have been different, if he would have been included in the preparations to be out there all by himself and come home and have this party all in full swing, the fat calf already killed, and everybody dancing, and him not included. Mm-hmm. If he would have been... If they would have rushed out and said, "Your younger brother is home, come on home." Mm-hmm. I've often wondered why, you know, I think we all would have had that attitude to come home and have a party going on and not even being told what it was about.
Right. The father doesn't fuss about that, whether he was told or not, but he goes right out, remember? He goes right out to him. Uh-huh. Yeah. It just says when the son came back, right off the bat, we'll give you a 2-week trial if you really mean this, so you don't do that. And then maybe 3 weeks from Thursday, we'll have a party.
But why didn't they run out and get the older brother and say, "Come on home"?
Well, when you tell a story, this is an old story. Jesus did not make up this story.
No.
It's an old story. Uh-huh. He just took it and used it. Uh-huh. So, but we can do anything we want with it. Mm-hmm. We can make it make the story that the kid who came back this was the seventh time. That might help the story for us today. And you can make it that they did bring him in, and he still didn't care about it. Could be either way. Uh-huh. He may or may not have. He may have just blown up in front of his father. Who knows? But do what we want with it. Uh-huh. But the story has got a point, and that is that the father immediately, before the kid has a chance to prove himself, ring, robe, shoes, fatted calf, let's go. Now, maybe it was because of the father's exuberance that the word didn't get out, but play with it. That's what part of scriptures is for as well. So that it does fit all of our situations and feelings about stuff. Somebody else.
One of the times we party.
Pardon?
One of the times we party is when we have the baptism. I mean, it seems to be the old thing when you have another dinner, wears everybody out, but it's still a celebration.
Yep.
Did Jesus change this story?
Pardon?
Did Jesus change this story when you said he took it?
Yeah, it was. The story appeared in a number of forms that at least these people talk about. One was given here by a Roman, some Roman writer, and I don't remember who it was. But it was a style of a story that was known. They were, you know, before books and all the other stuff, they were storytellers. And so you picked up the stuff going and went with it.
What you said about, the father being a maniac, John Schramm preached a sermon titled "The Prodigal Father."
Mm-hmm. Sure. Prodigious. Isn't it crazy that the word prodigal is used by so many people almost always, only in the context of this story?
What's the definition of prodigal?
Wasteful.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Yeah. Willing to throw it all away and flipping it to the father. Mm-hmm. Somebody else? Yes.
It's interesting to me that very often when you hear this sermon taught or preached, it ends with the fatted calf.
Yeah.
Yet a lot of literary critics these days are suggesting that, you know, dramatically, the whole tension of the story is at the very end,
yeah,
with the hanging question, and that
right.
A lot of folks would argue that everything that comes before is simply the setup, mm-hmm, so that Jesus can ask the same kind of question that he asked the Good Samaritan,
right,
you know, who proved neighbor, and now, are you going to join the party or not?
Right.
And so that we call this the prodigal son often, mm-hmm, but perhaps we got the right title, but we're talking about the wrong person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That it's really about we, mm-hmm, who waste the love that's always, mm-hmm, present to us, mm-hmm, with all our obsessing and worrying about who's getting the biggest piece of the pie and so
right.
forth. But, and certainly I think that fits with the overall context,
sure,
you know, that he's addressing
scribes and Pharisees,
scribes,
the Pharisees,
scribes and Pharisees
are grumbling, right? Why Danker calls it the reluctant brother, the story of the reluctant brother.
What's interesting is I think you often hear this exegeted in terms of repentance,
mm-hmm,
and you can make a very good case that there's no repentance
right.
in here, that to come to himself really means more to realize what the situation
right.
is and make a calculated assessment.
Sure.
This is a bummer.
I can get meals back there. I ain't got food.
Yeah,
I can get meals back there.
And what he says he's going to say to his father, mm-hmm, is a very stylized
yeah.
kind of thing. And what he's asking
mm-hmm.
is not humbling. He's actually asking for much more than he deserves.
For sure.
Because he doesn't deserve to even be a hired hand.
Right. And drops that.
We often make this into repentance sure. and okay. and so forth.
It's funny that in the preparation for us that he says hired hand when he gets home and does spot out, he doesn't say hired hand.
Well, yeah, anyway. Yeah. The point is he didn't even get it out.
Right, that's the point.
He said yeah, he didn't get his shtick out. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, somewhere
yeah.
this has been described as, God, the father has been described as the waiting father. Waiting.
Yeah, the waiting father. Helmut Thielicke, right?
Yeah.
Is that his book? He has a
right.
book entitled.
And that father is God waiting mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. us. Come to yeah. know him.
Sure. The waiting, loving, partying father.
That really dates me, doesn't it?
No.
Thinking on that book.
Well, as an advocate for
you
aging.
It was hot when I was a seminary, it wasn't that old.
Well, sometimes seminaries are about a generation behind, you know. If truth be told.
I think it also speaks to that that God invites everyone to the party. And sometimes in our blindness, in our resentfulness, we don't believe certain other people or peoples
yeah.
are invited to the party. You know, certain gender orientations, certain ethnic groups, whatever. And we don't believe that they have been invited to the party. I
Absolutely.
Think it speaks to that, too.
I do, too.
And our Creator, he invites everyone.
For sure. And that's why Holden should continue his advocacy of advocacy and also continue its advocacy of getting to know the partying father. That both of them, don't know always which comes first. But sometimes because we back off and don't do our thing out there the way we think we ought is partly because we're scared of all these other things, or partly because we still hate our other, but partly also because we got a locked up father and not a partying father who is celebrating the return of my son who was lost and my son who is dead and now is found and now is alive. Well, that's tough stuff, but that's why finding ways to say that again and again, and using as many, picking up Capon's book and anybody else's book that will help us do it.
Yeah. I think if our images of God are limited,
mm-hmm.
I mean, if we only see God in one
yep.
way, and
yep.
we only have one image, God's
mm-hmm.
only male, or God's mm-hmm. only female,
right.
or God's only this or that,
sure.
Then I think we have locked up God,
sure.
and we can't party with everyone.
Sure. And if we think only in terms of forgiveness, sins as the only relationship to God. Sins keeps out, forgiveness brings us in, rather than also biblical themes of liberation, which is that we're locked up, imprisoned, and need to be opened, or that we are captives in a distant land and have to be returned to reconcile, be reconciled to our home, to come home again. Finding all of those images and good, I think, feminine images, which will give us being back in the womb. I feel holding as a womb in these little valleys, grabbing me in, which is a lovely, lovely feminine, I think, image for me. And being embraced by the mountains. I like hugs, including the hugs of the mountains, God's mountains, to this place. You're right, I think. Yes, Dave.
I think of the story, and there are a lot of parallels to the church as mm-hmm. community that struck me this morning. We're so hot as a church about if somebody needs some space mm-hmm. and backs away for a while, especially with young people at our church. We mm-hmm. think if they decide to take a break from church, that we gotta get clowns into church so that they'll come back. Mm-hmm. and we just get so hot about that, but the story teaches us that God is patient and loving to give us the space to go out and empty ourselves again so that we have room for God again, no matter how well we have prepared them and nurtured them as they're growing up. There's going to be a space time.
Yep.
And I think of one very wise person in Seattle. Well, two stories. One
good.
In Seattle, when I suggested that we have communion or the Eucharist on Christmas Eve, one of the responses was, oh, I want to serve all those drunks. I would think that would be an important meal to say, even if you're a drunk. Mm. And another wise person in our church, we had one woman who was very concerned when people went around, which is a great ministry, but after a while it gets to be kind of irritating. And one man's wife was in one of those spaces, had been very, very active for a long time, did a lot of things, and I think kind of burned out and needed some space, but he kept coming.
Yeah.
And I give him credit because every week he was barraged with people. And I was standing once when a very well-meaning person came up and says, what are we going to do with Sue?
Oh.
And his comment was right away, and I just love you. Just love her.
That's it. Bless.
You know, if we are willing to let people have space and welcome them back to our party, which is the Eucharist,
sure.
And without questioning where they've been, without even needing to hear the story of their repentance and what a worm they are and all that.
Sure. Thanks. That's the lead into my close, which is to say we're back here again
right.
at a party, the Last Supper, the Lord's Supper, the Eucharist, the giving of thanks for all of us who were lost and are found again, for all of us who were dead and are alive again. And it's a big, big party. And so go and serve the Lord and throw a party at the Eucharist. Take care.
Good time.